Alicia.
And I'm Charlotte.
And we are two medical students trying to figure out our place in medicine by looking to the past and to current events to better understand the impact they have on us as women in medicine and women in general.
Yeah, and you can find or follow us on social media. We have Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, which are all at From Skirts to Scrubs. We also have a Twitter, which is at FSTS_podcast. And we also have a YouTube channel now where we are posting this, like, the literal recording that's going on right now in video content on YouTube. So go ahead and follow us, which is at From Skirts to Scrubs on YouTube as well. And then you can also check out our website where we have information on our episodes, show notes, sources, and more, which is at FromSkirtsToScrubs.com.
Yes. And you can also subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts, including YouTube, as we mentioned, and leave a rating and review. Apple Podcasts is the best place to do that, but you can also leave us a rating on Spotify.
So welcome back to episode 56. And I just want to start this episode by saying that Alicia and I matched into residency.
Yay!
We're going to be doctors.
We're going to be OBGYNs. I feel like for 4 years now, we've been like, oh, we're medical students. Oh, we're potentially OBGYNs. But now, guys, we are officially OBGYNs. We're going to be starting residency in July. It's going to be a whole thing, you know, once we start. But we're super excited. And look out, you know, for our Instagram. You'll see, like, where we're going and how excited we are. And we're going to be in the same city. So
we're so excited.
Super happy. Not the same program, but same city, which is the best we could hope for, honestly. So. Just a super fun announcement from us. All right. So I'm really excited to get back into my first episode of season 5 and starting off with, like, a good old historical episode. So if you are a day one listener, then you know how much I love to talk about hysteria. It is, like, the topic or one of the things that made me interested in women's health and history in the first place. And I just think it's really important and super interesting, which is why we've talked about it a ton. We've talked about it in multiple episodes. We had a whole hysteria episode itself. We also talked about it in the Wandering Womb, in the Rest Cure, in the Asylums episode. Like, it just, like, goes on and on, honestly, how much we've mentioned
it. Really keeps coming up.
It's so important. That's why it's so interesting. So in this journey of continuing to dive into the many different ways that hysteria has shaped women's history, we're going to talk today about the history of the surgical procedure, the hysterectomy. So before we get into it, any thoughts, Alicia, before we enter, you know, the whole story?
You know, I love this topic, but I think it's so interesting because I don't know anything about the history of how we came to do the hysterectomy.
Yeah.
I know what a hysterectomy is. I know the general steps of a hysterectomy. We did, like, a hysterectomy on a person's donated pelvis a couple weeks ago.
Nice. I'm doing that next week.
It's good stuff. But you know, I don't know anything about the history. And so I don't think I'll, like, dilly-dally. We should just get into it.
All right, let's jump into it.
That's more interesting than talking about literally
the surgical procedure.
Yeah.
All right, let's do it then. All right, so in order to really understand and appreciate the history, first we got to talk about, like, what the heck even is a hysterectomy? Like, I'm saying that because I know what it is, but that doesn't mean you know what it is. So a hysterectomy is a surgical procedure that removes the uterus from the body. And it can be done in a number of ways, which I will explain in a moment, and for a number of reasons. And so there's a bunch of different ways that you can remove the uterus from the body, and a lot of the ways that these surgeries are different are based on the anatomy and, like, how you're approaching the anatomy. So first, we're going to do a mini pelvic anatomy review because I don't think we've talked about pelvic anatomy for a while, and not everyone obviously knows what the pelvic anatomy is in someone with a uterus. So I want you to imagine a tiny little uterus in your mind. It can be, like, the cute little cartoon pink uterus with a smiley face on it if you really want. I don't really care what uterus looks like, but just imagine a uterus in your mind. Yes! Oh my God, Alicia! That is perfect. If you are watching the video, this is perfect time. Alicia, continue to hold that up as I explain what a uterus looks like. So the people who are listening, you can't see Alicia holding up her cute little plush uterus. But a uterus kind of looks like a cone structure where the, like, pointy part of the cone is pointing down. Yes. On either side of the top of the cone, there's a tube-like structure, which is called the fallopian tube. And those lead to the oval-shaped ovaries at the very end. Yeah. At the bottom of a cone, there's a squishy little donut structure, which is your cervix. And then this is not really an Alicia's plush toy, but on the other side of your cervix is your vaginal canal. All right. So now with that picture in mind of what your uterus looks like, we now have a uterus, tubes, ovaries, and all of that's connected to the vaginal canal via the cervix. But it's not just like hanging out in your pelvis with no help. There's things attached to it so that it's not floating around and wandering like a wandering womb. It's actually suspended in space by what you could imagine as like ropes, cables, things like that. These are the ligaments, arteries, veins, things that hold onto the anatomy and, you know, supply it in different ways. And then over that entire structure, there's a large sheet draped over it. And this is the broad ligament, which is kind of like this big blanket giving all the structures I just mentioned a really big hug. And that is me trying to describe female anatomy looks to you without actually showing you a picture.
Be good.
Thank you. Thank you. I think so too. All right. So now that we've had a little anatomy review, that'll help you think about the history a little bit more. But what do I mean by surgery that can move the uterus? There's like a ton of different ways this can happen. And we're not going to get too into the nitty gritty details of surgery because honestly, I don't want to bore you because that can get a little boring if you're not a surgeon. So one way you can remove a uterus is a vaginal hysterectomy. It's a procedure done literally between the legs through the vaginal canal. It's most commonly done in low-risk patients, and the uterus is pulled out, like, literally through the vaginal canal. You don't touch the abdomen at all. You can also do an abdominal hysterectomy, usually meaning open abdominal. This is common for, like, a fibroid uterus or different cancer cases that might need to, like, dig around a little bit more in the abdomen. There's also the radical hysterectomy, which we'll talk about later. It's when you remove basically all the things I just mentioned to you in that anatomy review, as well as pelvic lymph nodes. And then there's also minimally invasive approaches, which are things that are like laparoscopic, which you might not know what that means, but it's kind of like a mini camera going through your belly button and two little sticks on either side. And you can do it with these sticks and a camera kind of to remove the uterus and you don't have as many scars. You can also do that robotically, which personally, a robotic hysterectomy is my favorite surgery ever. I think they're amazing. So those are different ways that you can do hysterectomies. So there's a handful of ways to complete a hysterectomy, but it's important for me to mention, just for clarification, that a hysterectomy is just the removal of your uterus. If you're getting your tubes and your ovary removed, that is not called a hysterectomy. If you get all things mentioned removed, that's going to be a hysterectomy with a bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy. So it's just important to mention in case like you ever have these procedures done in the future and you're telling someone your medical history. If you say you have a hysterectomy, that doesn't mean your ovaries are gone. You have to have an oophorectomy on top of that. There's many layers.
Try saying that five times fast.
Oh my God. Every
hysterectomy, bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy.
It's like robotic hysterectomy. Everyone just says like BSO. But that's just important for like your own medical history. If you know someone who has a hysterectomy, like that doesn't mean they don't have ovaries. You know, just points of clarification. Okay. And then to wrap up this little review section, there are various reasons you can get a hysterectomy, like tons. One can be cancer. So if you have uterine cancer, cervical cancer, ovarian cancer, any of these reproductive cancer, sometimes even rectal cancer, then you could get a hysterectomy. Fibroids sometimes leads to getting hysterectomies, endometriosis. There's a ton of reasons, honestly. And everything's like unique to you and your own history and your medical conditions. So just so you know. All right, moving into the history portion. All right. So there is one very well-known gynecological text from history. Alicia, if you remember what it is called that we always talk about.
Is it the one by Galen?
No. But
is it the Egyptian one?
It is the Egyptian one. There is an Egyptian text. That's okay. There's an Egyptian text that we talk about, honestly, a lot because it's the first physical evidence of gynecology in history, and that's called the Ebers Papyrus. And I really want to go see it one day. I actually don't know what museum it's in, but I want to see it. Anyway, unfortunately, hysterectomies are actually not mentioned in this, which is surprising because, like, it's a huge gynecology text from ancient history. So there was no hysterectomies being done when that was written, as we can tell, which is interesting because usually that's where we start our histories. The first hysterectomy that's mentioned is actually from Saronis of Ephesus, who we've mentioned in the past, who also did a lot of gynecology. and that was in the first century in Rome, where he writes of a patient who had a prolapsed uterus that was literally black.
So
a couple things to digest here. One, what the heck is a prolapsed uterus? That is a uterus that is protruding out of your vaginal canal. And it's very common in women who have had many vaginal deliveries and older women, things like that. Things get a little loose and it can get a little like slacky and it like goes out through the vagina. So that is what this woman had. And then if you don't know, if something on your body is not already black, then it should not turn black. Like that's meaning that something is dying, you know? So if a uterus is poking out, it definitely should not be dead or the color black. So this woman basically had a necrosed, which is what dead is. Yes, a necrosed prolapsed uterus. In this story, they actually cut it off. So they said, oh, that uterus does not look healthy. We're just going to chop it off. So that technically was the first hysterectomy. It was basically a vaginal hysterectomy.
That checks out.
Yeah. And then around the same time, a physician named Themison of Lutetia from Athens is mentioned in a story of someone talking about a hysterectomy where they said, now one must not suppose the uterus to be essential for life. Not only does it prolapse, but in some cases, as Themison has related, it has even been cut away without bringing death. So they're like, okay, you can cut out a uterus, especially if it's falling out of the body. The patient will not die, which makes me think that hopefully some of the patients they were doing this hysterectomies on were alive. Because you'll see later that, you know, not all of them turned out so well. So I'm glad some women survived in the early first century. At its core, like these procedures are vaginal hysterectomies. Literally today, you're not going to be like, oh, wow, uterus is falling out through the vagina. Just chop it off. It's not that easy.
Chop it off. But, scissors. Yeah.
But it's essentially what the procedure is. All right. Then there's a lapse in time. Like that was the first century. Now we're jumping ahead to the 16th and 17th century. Between them, there's not much mention of hysterectomies. And at this point, there's much more going on with the procedure. And Alicia, what do you think like might have caused hysterectomies to become more common at this time? Like 16th, 17th century, some type of condition that people were like, we need to cut out the uterus.
Antibiotics?
No, it's the 16th and 17th century. Why would you cut off a uterus, especially if you can't like do x-rays and see stuff that's going on inside the body? Then you're seeing something happen outside the body.
This is a leading question and I don't know the answer.
That's okay. It's okay. It was cervical cancer. There was a lot of cervical cancer.
How on earth was I going to know that? Literally, how was I going to know that?
Because you can see it from outside the body. You don't need anything to like see inside the body, see cervical cancer.
Who was looking in the vagina? Who? The gynecologist. The speculum wasn't invented until ages later.
That doesn't mean
how was I supposed to know that?
I don't know. But we do talk more about cervical cancer in episode 52, where we like go through the whole history of cervical cancer, HPV, the pap smear, all that stuff. But without treatment, cervical cancer is like pretty nasty. It's bad. It can grow a lot and become this like cauliflower-like lesion in the vagina. It can eat into the uterus and the vaginal canal. It's really nasty cancer. And so hence the need for surgery can be quite high because you need to get that out of there. And with cervical cancer, a physician can like see the cancer through the vaginal canal. I don't know what they were using to do it because like Lucia said, no speculums at the time, but they could see the cancer like protruding from women. So they knew they needed to cut it off. So therefore, starting in the Renaissance in the 1500s and moving into the 1800s, we were seeing a lot more surgeries specifically done for cervical cancer. And then of course, like the prolapsed uterus. So the, yeah, so uterine prolapse and cervical cancer really led to like an rise in hysterectomies being done.
Okay.
And some of this history, yes, now that makes more sense, right? But some of this history can get a little nitpicky at this point. Like, oh, this surgical technique happened here. And then this man did this thing. And this man used this one small little technique. And I'm really not going to bore you guys with any of that. Like, I'm personally interested in minimally invasive gynecology, but I don't think you all are. And you don't want to know the details. But I, you know, we're still doing the episode for the reason that it's interesting. So I'm just going to generally talk about how hysterectomies developed in the 1800s as it like really became to be a major procedure. As vaginal hysterectomies started to come about in history, people, you know, had been performing them, for a while, but so many women were dying. And they'd be like, oh, the uterus was removed so successfully, but the patient died 3 days later. And that was happening all the time. Like, there were tons of uteruses being removed and then women dying right after. And if you had to guess, what was causing these women to die, Alicia?
Was it bleeding?
Yeah. These women were hemorrhaging like crazy, which means you were really bleeding out, because a big part of the anatomy of the uterus is that there's a ton of arteries, for one, going to the reproductive anatomy, to the ovaries, to the uterus, everywhere. But the big boy, the big kahuna, is the uterine artery.
Like, uterine artery.
Yeah. Like, this is a real sucker. When you cut it, it bleeds so much. Personal story of this. I was in a surgery with a general surgeon who was removing rectal cancer, and he was like, oh, I can do a hysterectomy. I'm going to perform a hysterectomy myself without gyn onc here. So he starts doing the hysterectomy, cuts the uterine artery, and there's blood everywhere. And no. Gynecologists and OBs are so used to blood. Not all surgeons are used to their field being super bloody. He was like, oh my God, we had to call in gyn onc. And the gyn onc was like, what have you done? Like, this shouldn't have bled so much if you knew where the uterine artery was and how to cut it correctly.
Did the ureters get chopped?
No, I don't think so, but it was really complicated because of the cancer. So we also had to call urology in to make sure that the ureter was fine, because the cancer had like eaten into the uterus, into the rectum, like everywhere kind of thing. It was a whole mess. The uterine artery can be really bad if you don't do the surgery correctly around it. So because of that, when this surgery was in its like rudimentary phases, a lot of women were dying because they were bleeding out, and the surgeons like didn't really know what was going on or like how to fix this, or they didn't have that surgical technique yet. They were doing their best to try and fix it. One man by the name of Jacopo Bernardo da Carpi of the 16th century, he was the first to try and use something to ligature the artery. So he used literal twine to ligature the artery. And then one specific surgery that was done in the 1800s was actually done by this man named Conrad Lagenbeck. And he was the first person to successfully do a hysterectomy, meaning the uterus was removed and the patient didn't die. This was for a cervical cancer patient. But this is actually kind of a funny story. So just mentally prepare yourself. All right. This man, Dr. Lagenbeck, was like, all right, time to perform the cervical cancer surgery. He had an assistant, but his assistant showed up to the surgery and he had a gout flare at the time. So
okay.
This is important, because the surgeon, one, tried to do the cervical cancer procedure as a vaginal hysterectomy, because that's what they knew at the time. And he had to do it alone because his assistant's toe hurt too much from his gout flare to help. So it got to the point where the surgeon is doing a surgery alone, which I can't even imagine doing a surgery without an assistant. And he was holding the ligaments of the uterus together with his teeth at one point in the surgery.
Oh my God.
Imagine putting your mouth in the surgical field.
Ew.
Isn't that so bad?
That's disgusting.
I can't imagine. I literally can't imagine. And he's like, dude, can you help me, please? And the assistant's like, sorry, man, my toe hurts too much. Like, I can't.
One of my friends, this is funny. It's like, it reminds me of when you're in the OR and you're the medical student, you're like not doing that much. And one of my friends was on his surgery rotation and he was on like an oncology rotation. So those involve like removing cancers, and then like you take like the sample and you usually send it to pathology, and they can like, those are the doctors who look at the cells and like know what kind of cells they are, if they're cancerous, blah, blah, blah. Helps with staging.
Mm-hmm.
They will hand you the specimen, so they'll like give you the sample of tissue. And he was like, I just had this intrusive thought, what if I just went and put it in my mouth and ate it?
That is an insane intrusive thought. I have never had an intrusive thought like that.
It's like, oh my god, the med student ate the tumor.
I thought you were gonna be like, oh, because sometimes like when I was on gynonc, they like hand me a specimen and be like, tag it for pathology, and like I'd have to like tie it twice here and once here or whatever. But never was I like, I should eat the specimen. That's hilarious though.
This is just an intrusive thought. This man was literally holding stuff in his teeth.
Yeah. And then at one point he lost the uterus. Don't know what that means. Don't know if it was lost in the abdomen. He had to like go in and find it, or if it was on the floor or what. But the uterus was successfully removed and then lost. So he had no proof of this uterus. Ridiculous. This was this whole thing was so ridiculous that a lot of people in the medical community was like, no, this is not a successful hysterectomy. Like, yes, your patient lived for 20 more years, but like, this was not a success. So anyway, that's the funny part. But it's also super important to note that like this whole procedure, this whole ridiculousness was done with the patient not under anesthesia. Because this was done in the early 1800s. And anesthesia was used for the first time until the mid 1800s. So all of the history we've talked about thus far practically was not under anesthesia because it wasn't.
That's crazy.
Created yet.
What were they
That's not
doing?
To say the
nothing.
Right? I don't know. It didn't say, but like, I can't imagine there was nothing. They still had opium. They still had alcohol. Like, they had ways, you know, to like dull the senses. And obviously people knew like that these things are going to hurt and they probably gave them pain medication, but like, that's different than anesthesia. Like, anesthesia is not just managing your pain. There's a lot of different levels to what anesthesia is and how it puts you to sleep per se for surgery. Yeah. And it's not just pain management. So they might have had pain management, but not, you know, not to the extreme they should. So something interesting to think about at this point, I think, is like, how does it feel, Alicia, to know that the beginnings of a surgery that is like very integral to our future profession that we're joining now, beneficial to so many women in society, was literally pioneered in like such a painful way? And we'll talk a little bit more later about some other questionable things about this history, but I think the lack of anesthesia, knowing how much like patients were dying to begin with in this story, is interesting to like,
yeah, I think it reminds me a lot of like our very early episode of the history of like the speculum and early OB-GYN and J. Marion Sims and Anarka Bethy and Lucy and the other enslaved Black women that were experimented on without anesthesia, without pain medication. And that's how we came across and came to learn about so many of the beneficial techniques that we use now. And I think that's one of the really dark sides of medicine. And that did not sound profound as I said it out loud, but I'm just like, I really do think that that is, people see it as ends justifying the means. And that's not really true, I don't think. Like, you can't just justify these horrible things that happened. And there's like room for reparations now. And there's like room to think about how we can minimize harm and minimize pain in our patients now. But yeah, looking back and knowing that that's the history is really terrible. And I think something we have to remind ourselves is, you know, we have to think about history in the context of the time. And there wasn't any anesthesia available at that time. And so it is unsurprising that they couldn't use any. But also they were curing these women of cervical cancer. And so I guess it's like a risk benefit analysis there too.
I agree. And I think something that differentiates this story from Anarka Betsy and Lucy in Dr. Sims is that that was done without consent. Like, those were enslaved women who were put through these procedures so many times. So awful. So terrible. I really recommend everyone listen to the episode. It's like our third or fourth episode. But I have to believe, and I hope to believe, that a lot of these women who are getting these surgeries done for prolapsed uterus, for cervical cancer, these are conditions that drastically alter your quality of life as a woman. I'd hope that these procedures are done under consent. So it's kind of interesting that like these women would consent to having a procedure done without like a fully fledged anesthesia occurring. And it kind of makes me think of, not the same, but similar to even like any clinical trial you join. Like, a lot of patients will consent to being a part of a clinical trial, especially if they have like a terminal illness, because they're like, if this trial can make me feel better, I will do it and I will suffer like the potential consequences so that, you know, I can like get better. And also like the general community of people with this condition can also benefit from me being in this. And I wonder if like, there's no way for me to like actually speculate and be like, yeah, that's what these women were like in the 1800s. But maybe they were like, I need this freaking prolapsed uterus out of my body. I don't care how much pain it is. It is getting in my way. I need it out. And they're like, I will do it anyway. Or like, you know, the cervical cancer is eating away at me. It's super uncomfortable. I can't have a sexual life, anything like that. They're like, I'm going to do this procedure despite anesthesia. It's just something interesting because I feel like they would have consented. I don't know though. I can't 100% say, but it's definitely very different than the previous situation we've talked about a lot with Anarka, Betsy, and Lucy, and that they didn't have consent at all, which really changes the whole story, I think, in my opinion.
I think, too, that their story, there was the existence of anesthesia, mm-hmm. but anesthesia was chosen to not be given. I think that's, like, a big difference, too.
That's true. Yeah, exactly. And this is, like, there wasn't as much anesthesia, especially when we talk about procedures happening in ancient times. Like, there was no anesthesia then. Like, there was no mm-mm. medicine then. They, you know, gave them opium and was like, we hope you don't feel this. Let's go. Something to consider. And at this point, I want to read a quote from the London Medico Review from 1825. And it says, "A more cruel, bloody, and ill-judged operation is not, we think, recorded in the annals of surgery. We consider the removal of uterus, not previously protruded or inverted, one of the most cruel and unfeasible operations that was ever projected or executed by the head or hand of man." So, kind of interesting. They were like, removing a uterus, kind of messed up, is what they were saying about hysterectomies at the time. They do say, you know, if it's protruded, then we should definitely remove it. But they're like, if it's not, then why? So that's something interesting to consider. All right, moving forward. We're still in the 1800s, but now a surgery that has become very popular and successful, it's not a hysterectomy, is the ovarectomy. So they're removing ovaries, becoming super common in the 1800s. And mostly it's because physicians were able to palpate, like, enlarged ovaries and cystic ovaries, and they were like, all right, we can get in there, remove them. You know, there's other abdominal surgeries being done. A lot of times they were being done by general surgeons who were already doing abdominal surgeries, and they saw the ovaries were all messed up, and they were like, let's get those boys out. If you ever look at an abdomen, I don't know why anyone would, but if you ever look at an abdomen where there's a really enlarged ovary, like, that boy is looking right at you. So people are like, let's get that out. So they were like, let's do that. And while that's really interesting, we could dive into, like, a whole history of ovaries being removed probably. Let's focus on the hysterectomy. So why I bring this up is important for our next story of a surgeon named Charles Clay. And Clay was practicing medicine in Manchester, England. He was performing an ovarectomy when a patient coughed, probably because there wasn't as good of anesthesia at the time. So she coughed during surgery. And while the abdomen was opened up, the uterus popped out. It was like, boop.
Oh my God.
And she actually had a fibroid uterus. So, like, a regular uterus should only be, like, the size of your fist. And a fibroid uterus can be ginormous. Like, I've seen fibroid uteruses that are as big as a basketball sometimes. Like, they can be huge. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how big this woman's was, but she coughed during surgery and the fibroid uterus went boop. And the surgeon, Dr. Clay, was like, maybe I should take this out too. This looks bad. And it popped out. Like, I don't know where to put it now. And so abdominal hysterectomies were born. Unfortunately, this patient also died from bleeding to death after the hysterectomy that was performed.
Dang.
Yep. And for some time, this continued to occur. Patients would go into surgery because doctors thought they had enlarged ovaries, and then they would get into the surgery and it would actually be a giant uterus or fibroid uterus or a cancerous uterus. And for whatever reason, they'd be like, let's get this out of here. They'd cut the uterus out. They'd cut the uterine artery and the patient would bleed to death. And that just kept happening over and over again to the point that the mortality rate of hysterectomies in the 1800s was 70%.
Bro, when did they figure it out then? Like, when did they finally get it together?
Yeah, so the first successful hysterectomy, not the one where the dude kept his teeth on the ligaments, like the actual first successful hysterectomy was in 1853, which is not that long after anesthesia started being used. And this patient was under anesthesia and they used much better surgical precautions because surgery was, like, finally starting to be like, maybe we should use instruments instead of our hands and, like, things like that. So surgery was advancing in general. Anesthesia had advanced. And therefore, we finally had a successful hysterectomy where the patient survived and did not bleed to death and kind of led on to more successful ones in the future. And the patient, after the surgery, which I thought was funny, had a cocktail of brandy and opium to help with her pain. So,
okay. Yeah, that'll do it. Well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good for her.
I know. Also around this time, the first C-hist happened, which is basically when you're in a C-section and you're trying to close up the uterus, which no matter how clean your C-section is, your uterus is going to bleed. And if it can't stop bleeding, they've done everything that you can possibly do. you have to remove the uterus. And it's like the last stop thing you do, but it happens. And it's called cesarean hysterectomy. But that also happened for the first time in like the 1850s.
Dang.
Yeah, I know. And sea hiss are crazy. I personally never seen one, but
me neither.
They're bad. You don't want one. You don't want to go into a C-section and come out with no uterus. That'll only happen if you are like, they're like saving your life by doing that. The last type of hysterectomy that we will cover today is the radical hysterectomy, which I briefly mentioned at the beginning. This procedure was developed in 1898, because surgeons noticed that they were removing the uterus and the ovaries and all this stuff to cure or attempt to cure cancer, but the patients were still having cancer and that the cancer was coming back in places outside of where it originally was and outside of these like margins or surgical margins or what they're called. So they thought, all right, well, if the cancer is coming back, let's remove more. So they started removing basically everything like by the uterus. They removed the whole uterus, all the ovaries, the tubes, the broad ligament, the cervix, the entire vaginal canal, all the pelvic lymph nodes, which are the things that cancer travels through, removing like the peritoneum, removing like as much as possible, basically, to make sure the cancer doesn't spread. And this surgery is super extreme. And there's a ton of complications to this. A lot of, you know, genital complications, fistulas that were formed, impairments, patient's sex life in the post-recovery period, like it's not great. And so it didn't last very long. Once radiation therapy was developed, radical hysterectomies became a lot less popular because now you can do a more conservative total hysterectomy where you still remove most of the things I mentioned, not the vaginal canal, but like the cervix up, and you remove like usually one or two pelvic lymph nodes just for staging, which is a lot more detailed process we won't get into today. But you can remove stuff and then do radiation on top to really make sure you get all the baby cancer cells that you can't even see. So we don't do radical hysterectomies anymore, but that was a crazy procedure that had a ton of complications, like put a lot of lymph node issues, just so many issues. And it was not great, but they were on the right track of thinking. They were like, this surgery actually sucks. We're not going to do this anymore.
Yeah.
And then just a few wrap up notes about the history of hysterectomies is that laparoscopic hysterectomies, which is the one with the camera through the belly button, that was developed in the 1980s. And now there's even robotic hysterectomies, which has a couple more cameras in the and the doctor sits in the corner of the room kind of playing a video game while the robot does it. And it's amazing. And then another thing is in the early 1900s, most hysterectomies were actually done by general surgeons because at that point, the field of gynecology wasn't like a separate surgical field than general surgery. And so a lot of general surgeons were doing these hysterectomies and they were already used to abdominal surgery. They didn't want to be like near the vagina. So they were doing abdominal hysterectomies. But today, if you're getting a hysterectomy and you're not a cancer patient, you will most likely either get a vaginal hysterectomy or a minimally invasive one, which is like laparoscopic or robotic, because they're a lot safer, they're a lot less scars, lower complication rates, etc. So before we end this episode, I just want to talk about the misuse of the hysterectomy, because it's an amazing, beautiful surgery. It has a future OBGYN. Like, it's so cool, but it has really been misused in has been used to mistreat women in the last like century since it has become a successful surgery that they can do without women dying. It's been used incorrectly on a lot of women. And there's like two instances I really want to talk about right now. Both of them are kind of things we've talked about before, but I just want to frame them specifically in the hysterectomy. First one is for sterilization, which is something we've talked about in episode 29 that Alicia talked about in great depth and everyone should for sure listen to. And it goes, you know, into a lot more history, but just to kind of like recap that here a little bit and talk about the hysterectomy. So there was the eugenics campaign of the 20th century. During this time period, there was a major push for states throughout the United States to sterilize women. So women who were deemed unfit to have children, or women that the government just simply didn't want to procreate, which included women with mental illnesses, incarcerated women, women with disabilities, women with high sexual activity, and most commonly women of color. Like I said, we talk about this so much more in Alicia's episode, but I just want to mention it here because specifically because the generation of women that were abused by these forced sterilization laws and procedures are the mothers and grandmothers of many women who need hysterectomies today. And this is important because whether you're someone who's been personally affected within your own family history by this, or you're a future medical provider, or if you have friends who are affected, like whatever reason, it's important to note because women who need hysterectomies today might feel really uncomfortable with the procedure might feel really uncomfortable talking about it, just knowing like how it was traumatic to their own family or to your patients that you're working with. And specifically, this is a big topic, especially for patients of color. And I bring this up because a 2009 study found that Black women are actually 4 times more likely to receive a hysterectomy than white women. And there can be many factors to this, but one really important thing to think about is fibroids, because fibroids is a huge reason people might get a hysterectomy. You can get a what's called a myomectomy, which is where you remove the fibroids from the uterus, but sometimes that's not always an option, or women don't want that and they want a hysterectomy. So fibroids can be a huge reason you get a hyst. And according to a 2020 article from the University of Michigan, 25% of reproductive age Black women have fibroids, which compared to white women is only 6% of white women have fibroids. So a lot of Black women have fibroids, which could lead them to having more hysterectomies. And then by the time Black women reach the age of 35, the percent of people who have fibroids can get up to 60%, which is a ton of people. And while fibroids don't always warrant a hysterectomy, there needs to be more research on understanding why Black women have such higher hysterectomy rates than white women in today's society, despite the fact of like the fibroid issue, because there's definitely like more confounding things in that equation of counseling. It's just important to consider because while the procedure should not be being done, and I hope to God not being done for eugenics today, the history is still very strongly tied to women of color who still have very high hysterectomy rates. And so it's just an important conversation, important things to talk about and think about if you're someone, you know, in that space. And it needs to be something that's looked into more of why Black women have more hysterectomies, especially with the negative history around that.
To add to that, and just like generally, a website actually that I only recently learned about, but that I think is an interesting, helpful resource for people who are thinking about hysterectomy or trying to find their options or just want to have like an online forum. There's a website called Hyster Sister.
Oh, I'm gonna look it up right now.
It's literally Hyster, like a patient open forum. They have a bajillion articles, and I can't necessarily speak to supporting all of these articles and everything that they post. But I think as long as you understand that going to that website is not getting medical advice, but just to hear about people's experiences and what things have worked and not worked for them going into or deciding to do surgery, I think it's like a really helpful resource. And like, I do know people have used that or I've just heard of that website. And so I wanted to throw that out there because I think, you know, when you get a surgery, often you'll like try to find other people who've gotten that surgery. How was their recovery? What was that like for them?
For sure.
And that makes the idea of getting surgery a lot less scary. And so I do think there's like a lot of benefit to having community and a forum of places for you to go and get this information or have your questions answered, but not just from a medical professional. This could be a good place, but it is important to listen to your doctor and to heed their advice when it comes to your specific case and your specific medical.
I mean, making a decision as big as a surgery, as big as a hysterectomy, especially if you are a reproductive aged woman, that's going to like end your chances of birthing your own child. If you get a hysterectomy in your reproductive age, it's important to make your own medical decisions. Like, medical decisions are a shared process. The doctor should not be telling you what to do. And they should be advising you on the options and recommending options to you and having a fully fledged, well-informed conversation with you about what you should do next. And then if you feel warranted that you need a second opinion for whatever reason, then that is totally up to you to do. And also, you know, rely on other people to hear theirs with in mind, of course, what the doctor advised to you. But no one should be telling you what to do. It's more, this is my professional advice and I'm here to support you. And, you know, let's talk about it. And so something to consider. And hysterectomy is like it's a major surgery. And so I love that, Hyster Sister. I'm going to write that down and recommend that to patients to check out then. The second thing and the last thing we'll talk about is the use of hysterectomies in asylums. We talked about asylums. It was the last episode of the last season. And it was a huge thing to do to women, unfortunately, in the 1800s. In asylums. And specifically, I want to talk about one physician from the London Asylum, Dr. Maurice Buck. And this doctor, who worked in London, believed the common belief at the time that if you treat the body, then you treat the mind. So your mind, if something going on with your mind, then you need to treat your physical body, which is slightly true today as well, of course. But he really took it to an extreme, to the belief that the idea of hysteria, where a uterus is causing a woman's illness, he thought, well, okay, if the uterus is causing issues, then we should just get rid of it. And so he used hysterectomies as a form of treatment for mental illnesses. And let's also consider this is being done on women in asylums who we know from the asylum episode most likely did not have consent in this process, had things done to them that they, you know, did not consent to or did not want. And a lot of women were put in asylums who did not have mental illnesses either. They were just put there as a way to constrain them and to, like, you know, have social pressures on women and, like, have the scare of being sent to asylums because you're not conforming to society. So a lot of women, you know, it's not correct to do a hysterectomy unconsented on anyone, mental illness or not, but there was a whole wide range of women this was happening to in asylums. Kind of crazy. And I actually read an entire speech this man gave. It was like 11 pages long that he gave to a gynecology medical society in London in the 1800s. And it was a lot. He basically went into numerous stories of female patients from these asylums where he removed their uteruses. And then he was like, oh, they were insane. And then I did hysterectomy and then they were cured, which there was like, I truly doubt that is what happened. But he claims he did this to like over 100 women. He did this until 1902, actually. Too recent for comfort, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And he did this to a ton of women. And this is only one asylum in London. This is not talking about other asylums throughout Europe, in the United States. Like, doctors talk. If this man was giving an entire speech to a medical society recounting how this surgery supposedly was curing women in his asylum he worked in, who knows, like, what was done in other asylums as well. So something really crazy to think about. And he stated in this address that many women are needlessly and improperly confined in asylums suffering from reflux cerebro, nervous disturbance, which is basically like them saying that they were insane, because of periuterine irritation or disease, which might be cured by operative or local treatment. This man was the king of false news. So hysterectomies were basically built on the backs of countless women who have died, women who are mistreated, to create this extremely beneficial surgery to women today. And it is used for so many conditions and is so important to especially gynecology oncology, where, you know, removing a uterus and other structures can literally save a patient's life with the treatments we have today. And as I mentioned many times, robotic hysterectomy is my favorite surgery ever. It's so clean and beautiful. So this is a very fun history for me to cover. And I hope you all enjoyed it too.
I'm just happy I got to use my plushie.
That was so unexpected and exciting. I didn't even tell you we were doing anatomy review. And
no, I had no idea. It just sits on my desk.
Oh my God, I love it. I need one. That's adorable. So anyway, you guys should subscribe to the podcast. We have so many episodes that come out every other Tuesday. You can subscribe on your favorite podcasting app. We don't care which app it is, but also try and leave us a rating and review. And Apple Podcasts and Spotify are great places for you to do that.
Yes. And you can follow us on social media, on our YouTube channel, as well as check out our website, which is from scrubs.com. That'll get you all of our show notes, our sources, merch, and more. And lastly, here's to the women who have fought for us to be where we are today. And may we do the same for those who come after us.
Yeah.
We'll see you next time.
See everyone next time. Bye.